So we would definitely be back.
But just in relation to the last module, I should or the next module, I should just say that for the tape, what I'm thinking. So the next, nothing over the summer. So the next course will be in September, where I think I'll be doing part one again. I always do part one, which is that just general introduction to phenomenology. We look at Husserl, Heidegger, Descartes. And then for the second, the January to March, the course we're doing now, I'm doing my sums, and I reckon that all the people from the last 3 years who are going to do this course have done it. So next year, if I did this again, I'd only be getting a handful of people who did the first part, and they'll thin out. I'll probably only have about four people, and that's sort of too few, I think. So I'm thinking that I'll do a new course next January to March, because I'm trying to tempt you back. Basically, I need ears. I need people, and I need eyes. You know, I need voices. I need all that you can bring. So I feel I have to do something that you might, I think I could do this again, and you'd get it'd be different, but you wouldn't know. Having something new is a good carrot in a way, isn't it? To turn up. And at the moment, I'm thinking it's going to be about language, and hermeneutics.
Oh yeah.
So, philosophy of hermeneutics. Hermeneutics, loosely understood, would be what came out of Husserl and Heidegger to do with language, and meaning. So it's a kind of a phenomenology of language and meaning. So less Western analytic philosophy of language, but I feel I might have to give you a bit of a background in that as well as part of the course, unless somebody else does it in FUB beforehand. I feel somebody ought to. If it's a philosophy degree, because there's a philosophy of mind course, generally philosophy, for me, they're the two crucial domains of 20th century philosophy in the West, in the Anglo-American tradition. That's where philosophy was really active. Language and philosophy of mind. So I'll keep an eye on whether anyone else is going to cover that. Otherwise, I might give you a quick John Searle snapshot. I thought John Searle was
We've done John Searle last year.
There. Where did you do John Searle?
Mind.
In intentionality.
Tom Bowman.
Well, philosophy of mind, different schools of philosophy of mind who gave an account of what the mind is and how it works.
Now, why I mention intentionality is because John Searle's account of the mind involves intentionality, is quite central to it. So I wonder if intentionality was mentioned there, because...
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was. They mentioned a lot.
Yeah, so that might be a bit confusing, because John Searle's idea of intentionality and Husserl's...
Different.
And it's Husserl and John Searle, and they both talk about intentionality. You can get a bit
it's
tangled.
It's more scientific. It's John Searle.
Yeah, no, but he is talking about intentionality.
Was that last year?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tom.
Yeah,
I thought that was the year before.
No, it was last year.
Oh yeah, it was last year.
Yeah.
Early last year, wasn't it? We looked at the John Searle book, Philosophy of Mind. Is that book?
Yeah,
an introduction to philosophy of mind. Yeah, yeah.
Apple face. Kind of.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
I remember.
Yes, I
dropped out.
I remember I liked the functionalism.
Yes.
People who thought. So I was like, wow, that makes sense. It's functionalism.
Yes.
It's
what it does that counts.
Yeah,
that's functionalism in a nutshell.
That's what
functionalism. Yes. Yeah.
For example,
doesn't matter.
I'm a Taoist and Buddhist, and I like this and about that. Well, I'm actually just Christian Orthodox. Look, that's kind of functionalism. It's not just what my account of things. It's just what I do, and I might have different interpretations of what I say or what I do. So that's functionalism, isn't it?
Well, functionalism in the philosophy of mind is something different, actually. Yes. Yeah, it says what determines something is what it does. And so you it very broadly, and then in the brain, it says something. It's sort of a defense of certain kind of artificial intelligence that says it something along the lines: if the computer does the same thing as the brain's doing, it has the same function, then it's equivalent. It's a kind of a functionalism is a sort of an argument for a kind of computational theory of mind. But we won't be talking about that. Let's get back to something much more indefinite. You see, if you want information, memorable information, don't come to Heidegger. Because that's one of the aspects, especially later Heidegger. If you at the end of the class, somebody asks you, well, what was it all about? And you say, I've no idea. That's good.
That's why I keep coming along to these courses.
Yes.
While probably coming along to the next one, because it's just embarrassing. I can't.
Yes. We certainly said a lot was said.
Yeah.
But what was it about?
Yeah.
I've no idea.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. Luckily, the Wikipedia page on phenomenology says that's about right.
Well,
it has to be elusive. It has to be evasive.
It's not quite like that. It's more that I think that phenomenology does not engage a certain part of the brain that deliberately, which we would call the calculative, rational, intellectual part of the brain. Phenomenology, in some sense, is not engaging that part of the brain. The part of the brain it does engage with is concerned with seeing now. And if what you're talking about can only be seen now in the moment, you can't remember it and describe it historically. The only way you could talk about what happens in this class to somebody else, if I'm on the money, is you have to bring whoever you're talking to, you have to give them the class. You have to bring them into the moment. You have to say, we were talking about this, and now I've got to show you.
I've tried.
I've got to show you what we were talking about. I can't just give you a catchphrase or two, or anyway.
But John, will you be doing this class next year?
No,
in the evening next. Not in the.
No, I'm going to do the hermeneutics this time next year, and then I think if we just live here forever,
in the winter. Next
yes,
winter.
That's what I mean.
Hermeneutics.
Yes.
We've got this.
I'm calling January to March winter, and September to December autumn.
Next autumn.
Next autumn,
not
part
this
one.
Autumn.
Next.
Oh, I'm getting confused.
This autumn. Autumn, September to December is always going to be part one, introduction to phenomenology. And then January to March is going to be open, changeable. I might rerun this course again in a more distant future when I've got some more people in part one who might want to do this. So it's to do with numbers of students and amount of interest.
Were there people in part one you just repeated the course?
Yes.
Were there as many people as
your year was bigger than this year. Yeah.
I think there isn't enough marketing.
Well, yeah.
Whenever I mention this course to people, people talk about, wow, that sounds interesting, and they kind of want to come, and then I send them the link, but then they don't.
And then they don't.
Well, that one person might come next.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it takes a certain kind of, I don't know what it is that keeps you here. It's mysterious, isn't it? It's because it's no good just having a big bunch of people who just aren't interested. It just wouldn't work. It's not that kind of class. There's got to be something about what I'm talking about that communicates, and that happens with some people and not with others. I don't know how you got to be in the class in the first place. Anyway, I assume Matt does something. Matt does something, and people turn up. I don't actually do anything myself.
I got manually.
You have to wear a Metallica t-shirt.
In bounds.
Alan, the famous beyond.
Yeah.
and said they're doing social sciences. And I said, that's great, but it's a bit broad. And then I got an email saying, because I'm enrolled on social sciences, I'm now enrolled on philosophy. So they just manually enrolled.
Yes.
Because I showed a little bit of interest. But I'm fascinated by how people, why people are turning up to these classes.
Yes. It's very puzzling, isn't it? It's very puzzling. It's hard to think how it's going to further anyone's, worldly interests. It's a kind of a little. I mean, it's not puzzling to me because I find this kind of stuff is the lifeblood of my kind of intellectual life. But I know from just chatting to. You know, there was no one in my family who I could talk to about this. You know, not really, except on a very, very occasional kind of peak moment, but generally not. Anyway, let's not go there. But if you do, you can mark it for me. If you see anyone you know who you think, yeah,
I'll tell my friend. I think he's going to be very interested. Him and his friend
But let's get back to the clearing of being.
Would you like me to show quickly this thing?
No, not now. Not now. Let's get through the class. I have to get to the end of the class. There's no next week. Do you know? So that we. Yes. No,
I'll
the year after next. So it's necessary for thinking, but we have to put thinking almost in a special category here. It's necessary for thinking to become explicitly aware of the matter here called clearing. We are not extracting mere notions from mere words. Rather, we must observe the unique matter that is named with the name clearing in accordance with the matter. What the word designates in the connection we are now thinking, free openness, is a primal matter. Ursache. Goethe notes, look for nothing behind phenomena. They themselves are what is to be learned. This means the phenomenon itself sets us the task of learning from it while questioning it, that is, of letting it say something to us. Do you see that? That's another sort of classic example of having said all that, where you're left really with nothing. Nothing definite there, except the sense that what is this primal matter? What is this clearing? It's just like a mirror. That text is just like a mirror reflecting back to you. So, okay, it's here now. This is the clearing. And in some way or other, although you're in it, and saying you're in it is wrong. Because there's no, you know, the language is wrong. There's no you in it. There just is the clearing. There's nothing behind it as well. Look for nothing behind it. That's what Goethe's quote is indicating. It's a letting the phenomenon itself say something to us, and this is a primal matter. This isn't something appearing in our experience that we look at and isolate. It's this primal phenomenon of the clearing, whereby anything that can be known, anything that comes to presence, requires this clearing, and it's the clearing that enables it. Another way to look at it negatively is when we looked at what the brain does, when we looked at the brain as a physical entity with all the neurons firing, and we'd say, when the neurons are firing like that, then you'll be experiencing that. When such and such is hitting your eye, then you'll be seeing such and such. That whole explanation of the cause and effect of how the brain works, there's no clearing in it. You see, the clearing just doesn't show up in that account. What there's no the clearing, certainly stuff that's going on in your brain is related to what appears in the clearing, right? To what appears in the clearing, but it doesn't make the clearing itself. The clearing itself is not something that can be the being of the clearing, if you like, if you can say that. It's hard to say even that, because all being is granted by the clearing. So the clearing isn't even a being, really. But there's no, you can't use something like a being, like the existence of something like a physical brain, to explain that there is a clearing in the first place. Do you see? There's an inexplicability in it. If we want to go and think of material cause and effect, you can look in the clearing and you can find an explanation in the clearing about why what's appearing in the clearing is appearing in the clearing. Do you get why there's a chair? You know, you can look into the brain, you can look into science, you can get an explanation about why what appears in the clearing is appearing. But none of that explains the clearing itself. It's another way of saying, none of that explains that there is experience rather than nothing. Just because some neurons are firing in your brain, that doesn't explain how there's a clearing within which the world appears. You see, it's elusive and not elusive. It's elusive, and yet it's somehow it's absolutely, it's just obvious that entire scientific materialistic understanding of how things work just doesn't see the clearing. I mean, in another way, I've been saying it is that it doesn't see consciousness. To which the science would say, yes, we do see consciousness, we study consciousness. I mean, you've been an advocate for this. Of course, we ask people what they're feeling. Yeah, we da-da-da-da. No, you ask people what's appearing in the clearing. Do you see? You don't... That there is the clearing is the inexplicability. That anything appears at all. That there's a space where everything appears. A brain can't make the space in which what appears. That is, in some sense, if you want to say it, that's just the brute reality. That's even to say you need to explain it is sort of absurd. Here it is. If I can remind you again, all philosophy, and Heidegger was talking about this, is a search for grounds out of which you can explain everything else. And the grounds of science is the material, and you try and explain everything out of the material. But this isn't a ground. The clearing isn't a ground out of which you explain anything. It's what self-evidently is. So do you see, to seek for some ground to explain the clearing is absurd, because the clearing is what grants everything, and it's within the clearing that we search for explanations of stuff appearing in the clearing. But you can't use that stuff to explain the clearing, and you don't need to explain the clearing, because the clearing in some sense is your very being. Just like a scientist doesn't explain matter. A scientist treats matter as the phenomenon. Yes, the primal matter is matter. So science doesn't explain matter itself. Science says, yeah, matter's just given. And we explain everything else out of that. But they don't see that the in a sense, that the primal phenomenon is what Heidegger's trying to indicate here. It's the clearing itself. And then he gets a bit poetic now. Accordingly, we may suggest that the day will come when we will not shun the question whether the clearing, free openness... Do you see that? I keep getting... Do you get the echo of the language? There's a freedom in it. This world of matter, if it were the truth, there's no, it's all... he's indicating something, some quality of where everything is appearing. The free openness is trying to express something that isn't material, isn't fixed, is a sheer potentiality. Anyway, may not be that within which alone pure space and ecstatic time and everything present and absent in them have the place that gathers and protects everything. So you see, it's the clearing that grants space, and ecstatic time for Heidegger is this pure becomingness, that we, every moment we exist, experience this pure becomingness. Everything is becoming, everything is moving through. And this comes from Kant, but it's been much refined. Kant thought that space and time were somehow something that pertains, space pertained to the world outside of us and time pertained to our inner world. And Heidegger is saying, no, there's the ecstatic time and pure space is the dimensionality of the clearing within which everything appears. And we can't help but project space and time into everything that we think. Like our model of the universe. And I guess one of the things, and Schopenhauer made a point of this, is that, and this is again to answer Maria's question, one of the reasons that you couldn't say that the star exists and you couldn't say it doesn't exist is because outside of the clearing you can no longer say that there is anything like space or time. So in what sense, because what is space and time, what do they enable? They enable you to distinguish one thing from another. Do you see, if there's no space, there's no separation. Space is a kind of an emptiness within which there's you there and you there. You take space away, which is saying there's no clearing, then there's no separation. There's no, you see, the clearing enables everything to be articulated. And if there's no time, there's no, nothing moves. Pardon?
Well, is he just doing phenomenology? That's what he's explaining.
But the sense that it's important in a way to get this intuition of space and time, what they are in themselves. It's all about just a flash insight of how there would, without them, there would be no experience, but that doesn't mean that there would be nothing. But what would be left if you took space and time away would be nothing that we just couldn't experience it. So it's nothing for us, if you like. If you take time, space and time away, what's left is nothing for us, for creatures like us, who have to experience everything spatio-temporally. So, if you like, one way to think about what lies outside the clearing, what is hidden, is the universe, but it isn't articulated in space and time anymore. It's, for us, it's a nothing. It's a something nothing. It's just something we just can't possibly grasp. The only way we could possibly grasp what it is for it to reveal itself in the clearing. And another David Bohm expresses it like the enfolding and unfolding. So he speaks of the entire universe. He's a quantum physicist, is enfolded within itself in a total unity, and then it's only in the clearing, he doesn't use that word, that it gets unfolded and made into something articulated and experientiable. And as soon as no clearing, then it's not that it's not there, it's just all folded into itself again and hidden. Hidden is a good word for it. It's a hidden, but it's a kind of in a everything's connected to everything elseness about it. It's only the clearing where things are pulled apart.
Uncovering.
Yeah.
You know, once the guy was, he was a Muslim guy, and he was trying to explain to me some stuff in the Quran, and he said that the people, sometimes he heard people saying kafir, which means infidel, and they blame people, you're a kafir, that means be stoned and stuff. Kafir comes from the verb in Arabic, kafara, which means to cover. Kafir is the person who covers. So if somebody is a kafir, it means that somebody is covering the God.
Yeah, the truth, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So it's a kind of a insult.
Yes.
Which is the same word, kafir, cover. It's the same word.
Yes.
Cover.
Yes, and of course there's... We do it at another level with language, don't we? Language is someone skilled in language can deceive you by covering.
Covering.
Yeah.
So if you're a coverer, then you're a bad person.
Yes.
God's
yes. Although sometimes you don't know what you're doing. Philosophy is ignorance, anyway. So philosophy knows nothing of the clearing. Philosophy does speak about the light of reason, but does not heed the clearing of being, capital B. The lumen naturale, which is, if you remember, Descartes. That's Descartes' phrase, the light of reason, throws light only on the open. It does not concern... It does concern the clearing, but so little does it form it that it needs it in order to be able to illuminate what is present in the clearing. So, I mean, he's talking about this kind of sense of wherever you look, sometimes people talk about attention like a searchlight. And we're if you like, we're aware of the light, of the searchlight, of the beam of our consciousness, if you like, that's looking around, but we don't heed the clearing. That's what he's saying. That the clearing is what grants in the first place, that enables, that articulates, that there is anything for the light of attention or awareness or reason to see anything. The first the clearing's needed. So there is no light and no brightness without the clearing. There's nothing for the light. The light won't appear unless there's a clearing for it. Again, it's all metaphorical, poetic. Even the darkness needs it. How else could we happen into darkness and wander through it? And again, it's metaphoric. And then Parmenides, Heidegger, the later Heidegger, had a lot of time for Parmenides. And all your, Parmenides was a pre-Socratic Greek philosopher, of whom only little fragments are left of what he wrote that are generally reported by somebody later than him. So it's quite unreliable what he said, and also quite unreliable what he might have meant and how he was using language. Because the further you go back in time, the harder it is to know that what the words themselves referred to. But Heidegger has some sense that he sees into the depths of the Greek origins of philosophy. And does it matter whether he does or not? I don't know. It's all about whether what Heidegger's saying is illuminating something to you. And also we should remember that this is Heidegger's translation of Parmenides into German that's then translated into English. So we're usually two steps away from Heidegger, we're three now. or from Parmenides. But you should learn all, the untrembling heart of unconcealment, well-rounded, and also the opinions of mortals who lack the ability to trust what is unconcealed. It's almost like an oracle, isn't it? You know, that. What could that mean? What could that mean? And remember, it's Aletheia is being translated as unconcealment by Heidegger here. So Aletheia, as I like to call it, unconcealment, is named here. It is called well-rounded because it is turned in the pure sphere of the circle in which beginning and end are everywhere the same. Do you know the T.S. Eliot poem? In the beginning is my end. One of the four quartets. Worth a read. Do you know there's T.S. Eliot, especially his later poems. He's one of the few poets in English, I think, who have resonance with some of these phenomenological ideas. Although he did end up, Anglican, didn't he, or Catholic. He there's a lot of religious stuff in his poems. But at the same time, his whole working with language, you can feel he's working like Heidegger, trying to get something out of language that he's got something he wants to say, and he's just having to create language in front of you. Some of Eliot's poems are incredible like that. For me, anyway, you know, a good poem just echoes on you. You read it once and you think, what does that mean? And then it comes to your mind when you're in a moment where you need to say something and you can't say it, and suddenly you think, Eliot said it. Anyway, I'll just commend Eliot to you. So yes, in this turning there is no possibility of twisting, distortion and closure. The meditative man, right, and we've had trouble with it, is to experience the untrembling heart of unconcealment. Unconcealment means the place of stillness that gathers in itself what first grants unconcealment. That is the clearing of what is open. So this is where we're starting to... We were mentioning earlier about, did Heidegger's thought become Eastern? And this is the beginning of what looks to me like a state of having cleared the mind, that the clearing in a way isn't just the clearing where this room is, but there's a corresponding clearing inside one's own mental processes. That in some sense you have to become yourself this space. You know that it requires a still mind. That is, as long as you're thinking and you're following your thoughts and you're saying, oh, I like that, I don't like that. It's like your thinking, in some sense or other, is attaching you to what's appearing in the clearing. So you can't see the clearing itself. you know, as long as you're, as long as your mind's active, it's going and you're, the clearing itself is only and what's the word, you can only discern it or get a sense of it or get an intimation of it if you become in some sense like it within. So it's a matter of becoming still to get a sense of what Heidegger's talking about. And this is one of the few places where he says meditative, place of stillness. Because I'm sure my sense is that in his hut in Totenburg, when he's doing his writing, that's where he's gone. He's gone to meditate, in the sense that the East meant it, that the total stilling of the mind and an attunement to something that is vaster than your own personal little world. You know, that as your personal little world quietens down, then the sense is that there's this kind of a seamlessness in, I mean, I would use the word consciousness, that your consciousness is no longer personal. It's you the sounds that are around you, particularly I find it with sound, you know, you are in some sense one with all of the sounds, and they're not going on in your head, and they're not going on in and out there, and there's an in here. There's just the sound, the pure sound. Sight's harder, because sight tends to make a thing, and you're here, the thing's there. But sound, I find, is you get attuned to sound, and there's an attunement there to the clearing as well. Because what's the space in which the sound's occurring? There's a space of silence. You see how you can't say it? I do. You can't say it. You can just do that. You just hold your hands and you say, so.
Is he talking about direct knowledge of consciousness?
Well, I reckon he is. That's yes.
Yeah.
That was what I was writing about in the very first reading I gave at the beginning of philosophy. You were probably there, Alex. Yeah. Direct knowledge of consciousness, getting the mind to stop thinking, and getting a getting a direct intimation of what it is to be conscious. Yes. The answer to that is yes. A direct intimation of what it is to be conscious is a knowledge, I think, in Heidegger's language, of the clearing. But knowledge, that's why I call it direct knowledge, because it's not knowledge that you think about over there. You know it only in the moment of knowing it. It's not a possession like that. So, we have already reflected upon the fact that the path of thinking needs the traversable clearing. That was when he was mentioning, where's Hegel doing all his speculative dialectic?
They say rise and fall.
Yes.
The rising and falling of the rise and fall.
Yes.
Because everything is like rising and falling. Yeah, thought it rises and falls.
Yes.
Now it rises and
yes.
Falls.
Yeah. And and the space that allows the thought is the space that allows the sound, is the space that is where you see. It's the same. It's the clearing. It's an amazing. It's only amazing if you can get you've got to get a fraction of a second sense of what it would be to not have it, which is just in a way a sense of there being nothing. Which, I guess, to an extent, every night we sort of do slip out. We might dream, and there's a clearing again in the dream, but I think there's a certain kind of semi-intuitive knowledge when you, after being in a deep sleep and being absent, that, I'm back. But in that clearing rests possible radiance, that is, the possible presencing of presence. So we're not representing anything in the clearing. This was Metzinger's view, that consciousness is a kind of a representing of stuff going on in your brain. For Heidegger, the phenomenology, and for me, I don't want to just say it's Heidegger, is unambiguous. You're present to me. You're presencing. You're actually presencing. You're listening to me. You're showing yourself to me. I'm not looking at something in my brain. I'm looking at you. And that everything that's happening is happening. It's making, it's becoming presence. Presencing means the, it's another word for being. Yes, and this is the, I better watch out I don't finish early. That'd be terrible, wouldn't it? That'd be a first. He wants now to talk about being and thinking. This is another Parmenidean thing. Because Parmenides, in one of his other longer fragments, actually equates being and thinking. Thinks of them as one and the same. So he must have had a different notion to us, right? Because we tend to think of thinking as something that's going on in my head, and the stuff that I think about is sort of subjective, and the being of things is something material out there that's distinct from my thinking. But Heidegger's now wants to, he's coming from Parmenides, he wants to sort of say, you know, that our thinking is actually an apprehending. It's not just thinking about stuff there, but he means thinking in that sense that Descartes also meant that when you apprehend the chair, that's a kind of a thinking. That that there isn't like the being of the chair distinct from my apprehending it. The two come together in the presencing of the chair. Yeah, there's something behind the presencing of the chair, if you like, in the hidden. But the chair doesn't get to have its being as the distinct thing that it is, unless it's apprehended. So my apprehending is bringing the chair into being. But I'm not creating the chair. I haven't made the chair. Do you see? There's a meeting of my apprehending and the being of the chair. And the same as there's a meeting of my apprehension of Joe, and of Joe walking in the room. You see that there's the meeting of the being of the other beings. We're interesting, you see. You know, it's a bit unclear to me whether the chair, what kind of being the chair has when it's not being apprehended. But if I apprehend you, I'm pretty sure that you have a being without me apprehending you.
Not really.
I'm pretty sure on that one. So, you may think
children don't think that of their teachers. You know, it's often the case that teachers say that kids say to them with amazement on a Monday morning, "I saw you in town today, on Saturday. I saw you in town on Saturday." You know, as if they somehow, teachers don't have an existence outside of
yes
when they're in
yeah. There was a reading I didn't give you from Piaget, or about Piaget, about all of that, how you learn to perceive, and how one of the things that you learn, it takes a lot of effort, is to learn that there's a continuity to things.
Yeah.
That they don't just, because a child would understand the clearing, no problem, right? As soon as I look the other way, you're gone.
Yeah.
You're out of it. You don't exist anymore. All that exists is what's in the clearing. And we learn to have a sense of the continuity of the being of beings outside of the clearing. And Heidegger, in a way, is saying, "Well, no, there's this this early Greek sense is closer to the truth of our being. It's we start to get a model of being that assumes that everything is just the way that we see it when we do see it, when we don't see it. Do you know that? That's the model, isn't it, we have? It's the old philosophical conundrum. You know, does the tree make a sound when it falls in the empty forest? The answer being, no. I think that's quite an ambiguous answer. You know, for there to be a sound, there has to be a brain. You know. Even if you're a Metzinger, I think you'd have to. The sound doesn't exist as a sound unless it's heard.
Because of the word sound.
Well, not just that, but I'll accept that if we just use the science, when the tree falls, there's just it disturbs the molecules in the air, but the molecules in the air moving around don't make a sound. Yes, but you need an ear with the hairs in the ear that are excited by the molecules that then get translated up into a brain that then becomes an experience of sound. This isn't phenomenology. You could have another device that's sensitive to the molecules in the air that's a photographic plate that would, in a way, you'd say, would you say that heard the tree fall because it picked up the movement of the molecules? No, it turned it into a picture. But once again, it's not a picture unless somebody sees it. Yeah.
In whose mind is it a tree?
Who's distinguishing one tree from another?
In whose mind is there a sound? In whose mind there is anything?
Yes. I mean, there is a question there about, does the tree have a being? And I think we probably would have to say from our reflections on autopoiesis and life and the organism that yes, I think that the answer to that is a yes. Not at all. I'm not prepared to give you a description of the tree's experience, though.
There's a war going on as well on the ground.
There's all the roots and the fungi and
they're very territorial.
The connections going on there.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Oh, yeah. But at the same time, I don't think the trees can see and hear. They don't have eyes and ears like we do, which actually form where the form. You see, in order to hear, you need, in some sense, to be sensitive to the form of the excitation of the waves over time. And there's no indication that the trees are sensitive like that. They're sensitive to other stuff, so they'd have a different kind of experience if they're having an experience. But they're not seeing and hearing. That's an attribute of animals that move.
I don't know if it's true. They tried to play Mozart to plants, and they reacted to it. And then they tried to play death metal, and then they died. they played music to the plants.
To which I would say that what we're measuring there. Here's my hypothesis. What we're measuring there is that back there, my intention in doing that experiment was that you'd really like Mozart, because I really like Mozart. I'm talking to the tree, and you won't like heavy metal, because I really don't like heavy metal. And the tree back there is also connected in some way back to life. And so I've been able to communicate my liking of Mozart through the psyche to the tree, but it wasn't anything to do with the air molecules. That would be my prediction. So I think we've misinterpreted the results of that experiment, because the trees don't have ears. But that doesn't mean that they're insensitive to us entirely, right? Because I think there is a unity, symbolically, right? The life from the very first self-reproducing cells in the ocean, we are connected. The whole blooming lot of us—it's laid out in the physical. The energetically, one cell's died, another's born. The cells in our body are connected in a chain all the way back to the origin of life, seamlessly. And I predict if we ever get to a point where we can actually, in some sense, verify this, that will turn out to be the case, that all of life, in some sense, that's ever lived, is in some sense present to us. And the physical, you know, what biology and science has discovered, is a kind of a physical representation of that. But I digress, but it is the last week. And even if that isn't true, I think it's a better story than Darwin's. If you're going to believe a story, you know, you should pick one that makes you feel better.
Darwin wrote another book after the Origin of Species.
Yes.
And that book is a bit kind of like, for some reason, it's like played down, or like they don't mention it at all. They just mention the Origin of Species.
Was it The Descent of Man?
I think so.
Not that I've read a lot about Darwin. Well, I only know Origin of Species. You know, it's a one-hit wonder for me. But he must have done other stuff.
Yeah, he's done a lot of other stuff as well.
Yes.
But like, for some, it's not mentioned. Why is it only the Origin of Species?
But even then, hardly anyone's read it. I remember a colleague of mine, when the e-books first came out, and he was reading Origin of Species on the bus going to work, and I was impressed because hardly anyone ever goes back to the source.
Yeah, you just hear about the audience.
Yes.
Who actually reads the audience?
Well, not me. Not me. Yeah. I already feel that it's going to be a bit dull, but I actually haven't tried it. It may not be.
No, I don't think it's going to be dull. Because, you know, he was in the 19th century, and language is very vibrant back then.
Yes, yeah, and they used to be more poetic in there, even in scientific writing. All right, we're just going to... carry on with aletheia, aletheia, unconcealment, as the clearing that first grants being and thinking their presencing to and for each other. I mean, he uses language very carefully here. It's almost a shame that I wander around it. I feel my own language is quite loose in comparison. Each of those words is carefully measured. Grants being and thinking their presencing to and for each other. So do you see that he's saying that in some sense our apprehending of being is for being as well. It's not just for us, that our apprehending has some effect on the iridescent bird of paradise, if you like. But not in its brain necessarily. Again, it's going to come up later. How could you possibly prove all of this? You can't, right? You can't. It's in a way, this is an... You know, we go back to the beginning. This is an invitation.
It's more like, my heart is my witness.
It's a preparatory becoming sensitive to something. And yes, the heart is mentioned, isn't it? The quiet heart of the clearing. And Parmenides is talking about the...
Untrembling.
What was it?
Untrembling.
The path to aletheia is distinguished from the lane along which the opinion of mortals wanders. I can almost feel the contempt with which that's said, the opinion of mortals. Again, this is a Parmenidean and very Greek episteme, which is where epistemology comes from, is knowledge, and doxa is opinion. And if you like, what philosophy is for the Greeks is the pursuit of knowledge, in contrast to the opinion of basically the the people in the street, that humanity by and large just has opinions and has no knowledge. Pardon?
Annoying opinions. Like people who are stand by to their opinions.
Yes.
They think their opinions.
Yes. I mean, opinion, behind opinion is belief, and behind the belief is not knowing. And the idea of philosophy, whether it's achieved it or not, is to say, I, in some sense or other, the philosopher is embarking on a, I don't want to believe, I want to know. And again, I'm reminded of Carl Jung. That's exactly his approach to the psyche. I don't believe anything. The thing about phenomenology is the phenomenology gives you knowledge, but in a terribly simple way. You have knowledge of what I'm saying now.
He doesn't believe in God. He knows.
Yes, that's right. You can even impersonate his Swiss accent where he says that. He said that on a famous interview he did. Do you believe in God? Yeah, I don't believe in God. I know God. If you listen to because I've been studying Jung, he means, I think, that he's had some sort of direct experience in the psyche of what people call God. That doesn't mean that he knows that God exists as something beyond what appears in the psyche. Yeah, does that make sense? Again, it's a phenomenological distinction. The thing about phenomenology is it doesn't say that there's anything behind appearances, and that's where opinion enters. Right, when you start saying there's matter and nothing else, you're expressing an opinion that you can't. There's no way that you can verify it. But then you might be saying, well, isn't Heidegger expressing an opinion here? And he doesn't think he is. What's the difference? Can I leave that hanging? Because I know that if we get to the slide or the slide after this, Aristotle's going to have a word to say on that. So aletheia is nothing mortal, just as little as death itself, which is another way of saying it's not personal. It doesn't belong to you. You don't have your little aletheia space. The granting that you're being granted this clearing in which to live your life, the clearing doesn't live and die with you, is what he's saying. Your little life that is rounded with a sleep appears in the clearing. So, but again, this is just Heidegger almost pronouncing. He's pronouncing some sense of some poetic sense of what the clearing is. I mean, he's got more to say on it. It's not because the way that beings' presence in the clearing does change. So he speaks of that. You know, in different cultures, in different times, then there is different. The presencing alters according to the culture, according to the times, according to, you know, he talks a lot about how our technological society has changed the way that beings presence for us. We're starting to experience things as commodities. The latest I heard from where I was at a conference, even less, things are becoming options. Things are losing their almost their objectivity, and they're just becoming options for us, things that we may or may not choose to consume or own, which is an understanding of being that just wasn't present in the past.
Right. So I think it's Schopenhauer as well, talks about this, that, and other people as well, that you know, when you get specialised in something, you acquire a skill, and then you know about something, then you know something, it's just, and then the point should be not just to know something for its sake, but the point should be to kind of elevate the being and kind of clear, make everything. Because you might know something, for example, you studied something, and then you just forget about it, but you're a different person now.
Yes.
So do different, what kind of different person? It kind of elevates the being.
Yes.
To experiencing a deeper, a deeper mode of existence.
Yes, that's true. I've experienced that in my life.
Right. So
but fortunately, because I do forget more and more.
Details.
More and more I forget what I've read and what I've,
yeah,
and what I've learned.
But
and,
that's not the point.
But
I remember.
Yeah, but in some way or other.
To
yes.
Reach
yeah, yeah.
A position.
Or it's
if you're already there, then you don't care about that shouldn't have any value anymore, this particular, this bunch of details that brought you to this stage.
Yes.
The important thing is to reach this stage.
Yeah, but if you want to teach, you need to be able to.
Always the practical. Always the practical joke.
We're talking about this clearance.
Yeah.
Of
yeah.
Being and all
no, the fact you can't. If there are certain subjects that you teach that you need to be able to remember the facts because you're teaching the facts, but there are other. The, like an area like this, it sort of almost entirely relies on self-knowledge, on the fact that you've seen stuff in the past. The fact you've forgotten about it doesn't matter because in some way or other, in some weird way or other, that the knowledge is still in you when you need it. But it isn't really at your beck and call. It's a bit like being able to ride a bicycle. You know, you can't really describe it, but you can get on a bike and ride it. Some of the things that are come up if you teach this kind of material, you can't really remember what you read or what somebody said, but some of it will be at your disposal if you're in the right place.
When you climb the ladder,
yeah,
you only need this.
Yeah, throw the ladder away. That's Wittgenstein.
Okay. Yeah, well, once you don't need it, that's it. You don't need it anymore.
Yeah.
You need the other one.
Yeah, you need a new ladder. Need another one. Yes. Now let's just finish this lecture, shall we? So it's nothing mortal. Again, so at a certain level here, where you have to almost be in two worlds. One world still has to say, well, how does Heidegger know this? And the answer to that is, well, do you get any kind of intimation of what he's talking about? Because that's all, he's not sort of presenting, this is a fact, this is a fact, this is a fact, this is a fact. In some sense, he's trying to make you sensitive to something. You know that it's preparatory, it's an intimation. All at the beginning of the lecture, all those words he used, and what he's saying is like that. The it being nothing mortal is almost an atmosphere that this in some sense goes beyond your own, the purview of your own limited life. Unconcealment is, so to speak, the element in which being and thinking and their belonging together exist. And reading thinking as apprehending. Aletheia is named at the beginning of philosophy, but afterwards it is not explicitly thought as such by philosophy. Named by Parmenides. Okay, that's what it means. For since Aristotle, it has become the task of philosophy as metaphysics to think beings as such ontotheologically, in terms of their ground, in terms of their where they may have come from. So to think theologically is to think that there's a God that made it all. So there's a God that creates, onto meaning being. So for Aristotle, it was the unmoved mover. There needed to be some God principle that lies behind it and provides a foundation for it. Whereas if we remain true to phenomenology, we don't go behind the appearance. It's all, if there's anything to be known, it's about the clearing. It's in the clearing. Do you see the distinction? You don't suddenly think, oh, there's a God, must be a God that made the clearing. No, that's not phenomenology. That's an opinion almost. Unless suddenly something like God appears, then it's a different matter.
Or it's felt.
Yeah, or is it appear? But even the feeling is an appearance. Yes.
Yeah.
But to think there must be a God.
That's how many people become religious, isn't it? Because they feel like Jesus or God appears to them.
Yes.
In some way.
Yeah. Yes, and that's many people, scientific people, don't recognise that. They think, are you believe in God because you were very insecure or something, but. Yes.
I was listening to three students talk about their experience of meeting God or hearing God, and there was one guy that said he heard the voice of God. He sounded like a father in his dream.
Yes.
Come to him and say, get up and do your, because I think he was at the union slacking.
Yes.
So him, that was the voice of God, but maybe it might have been just his dream.
Yes. Yes, this is like what I was saying. That's what Jung was talking about as well, saying that he knows God because, in a way, God's spoken to him. God's appeared. But you still can't, even though God's appeared, you still can't say, oh, that means that there really is a God behind what appears. All we really have is what appears.
God's spoken to me in dreams.
Yes. Yes.
And I shouted back.
Yes,
at
him. Get out of here.
Yeah.
Get out of my space. I was going to say, I guess my sense, I had a good friend. Yeah. I had a friend who was really embraced kind of fundamental Christianity, and he was an academic, you know, down the corridor, and I was working with him. And my observation of him was because he took it terribly seriously, and he was really an intelligent individual. So it wasn't a matter of not being intelligent. I had a sense that all the people who've believed in Christianity in the past have made a kind of a Christian area in the psyche, if you're attracted to it or vulnerable to it in any way, it depends depends how you think about it, you can become immersed in it. And it's like a world, and because millions of people have really believed this, it's like a world that explains everything. I was amazed at my colleagues, because he was saying, you know, carbon dating. Well, it's very questionable, actually, if you look into it. And I could just see, oh no, because it's like the whole world makes sense within itself, because so many people have lived there and thought it all. He couldn't have thought it all out for himself, do you know? He became immersed in an entire worldview that's already prepared for you. And you go in there and you think, this is amazing. Do you know, this is a revelation. It must be God. Right? But in a way, the scientific worldview is like that too. You know, you can get sucked into that. And it's amazing. It all makes sense. I see it now. that, and it seems like the psyche is full of these little spots where if you let it, if you agree, in you go. And you know, I think most of humanity is living more or less in one of those little places in the psyche. The only question we have to ask, you know, as philosophers, is it true?
Yeah, I notice when you start, many people are really kind of like, you notice that the consciousness disappears and they get sucked in into this, and then they come back from it, from that, whatever it is. They get gravitated into it, come out of it, you know, and they start contradicting themselves. I asked this guy who was like very, very religious. I in the end, I told him this, look, would you like me to pay Al Jizya for you? Jizya is a special tax that Christians should pay in the Islamic State. I said, you want me to pay, which is like a kind of a special tax, a heavy tax to, it's not a nice thing. It's like paying tax for belonging to a certain,
for not believing.
For not believing in Islam. Yes. That's the kind of tax that you should pay in this Islamic State. And I thought, you want me to pay this? And so, of course not. Then how come you believe in it? I say, it's not my fault.
No.
And so he was like contradicting him. So he's, because he was looking at me with love and appreciation and respect, you know, as somebody he's like hanging out with and stuff. But like his belief that I should be, he was like, sometimes he goes there to disbelieve, and then sometimes he comes back, he looks at me, that I'm flesh and like human like him. That why am I supposed to pay jizya for him? And he was very much ready to kind of like welcome me in his house, or maybe, or like a very hospitable
it's
person.
It's called cognitive dissonance, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it's a kind of...
I had somebody who was a strong believer, who knew me quite well, and said, you know, Maria, I always think it's such a shame, because you're quite a nice person, really. Such a shame that you're going to burn in hell for eternity.
Well, it is a shame. It does seem a shame, doesn't it?
Why am I going to burn in hell? Why, by your lights, am I going to burn in hell for eternity if I'm a nice person? Oh, because you're a non-believer. Mm. And that's what happens to non-believers. I said, well, it doesn't seem very fair, does it, really? Like, if I've lost my faith, in a way, that's not my fault. No, absolutely believe that, you know, was my friend, was friendly with me and socialised with me, but believed 100% that when I died, rotting in hell for eternity, that was my, that's what was going to happen to me.
So I feel I've got to pull things back a little bit, and also for the benefit of the recording, to say that I know that there are I know you want me to edit that bit out.
<It's>, okay.
I know that there are people who are quite conscious about their affiliation to being a certain religion, that they haven't become, if you like, a member. That my friend really embraced a kind of a radical version of Christianity that just doesn't square up with what we know about the world. But there are many people I think who get some kind of connection to a deeper meaning in the psyche through religion, and that in some sense they know that that's what they're doing. It's not a matter of believing that you're going to burn in hell and all the rest of it. There's versions of Christianity which intelligent people like Rupert Sheldrake, if you know Rupert, adhere to, who see Christianity as something like a rich heritage that we have that can connect us back to some spiritual depths, that the symbology of Christianity is still something that can, for those of us in, you know, in the West, Western Europe, we can still resonate with it in a certain way that connects us to a genuine it's difficult to say, sense of that there are depths in the psyche that if you're in touch with them, are enriching to your life.
That's what's happening in Russia now. They're bringing all of this Christianity back and the saints and everything.
Yeah.
And they're taking it as a kind of a national... They're employing all this Christian heritage, Christian orthodoxy, into the national idea, Russian nationalism.
Yes.
The culture and the
society kind of thing.
The national kind of feeling.
Yes.
The national.
I almost feel it myself.
Yeah.
You know, it's with the iconography of the the Orthodox Church.
Yeah.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? And you can sort of.
In the military, they put the.
They're back, they've got the Tsar back. They have.
There's a Putin as well.
Yeah,
that's
what I mean.
Icons.
That's what I mean.
There are leaked pictures of Russia.
It's amazing, isn't it?
They're like bending.
Yeah, that's
Putin's.
Because it's the same thing as it seems like. The same thing. That was prepared by millions of Russians over many centuries. So there's a little place in the psyche where that it doesn't go away. It's like we've had all this communism, but that's still there.
They never change their thinking in religion and everything. Also, if it was communist, but they continue to practice and everything under control. No?
Yes, but it's not just them, right? I mean, look at every culture has all this stuff that. You know, it's pretty scary material, actually. It's, you know, hold on to this little light, you know. Hold on tight.
It could be a cohesive kind of ingredient to get people together.
Yeah, yeah.
Form what birth and what flocks.
Yeah.
It could be something like that.
Yeah. Well, that sense of that you get from surrendering your individuality to the consciousness of a group is intoxicating.
And for some reason, that doesn't work with modern liberal societal capitalism.
Yeah, what you mean, like Germany in the Second World War? Wasn't that long ago, was it? Let's see if Brexit goes really badly wrong. How nice it is here. You know, these things aren't far under the surface. I think it's a mistake to think that we're home free.
Yeah.
You know, we're in a little bit of an oasis that I think we could easily look back on and say, oh my God, I was complaining. Austerity? That wasn't austerity.
No.
This is austerity.
Mm.
You know, living in the ruins of our culture, that would be austerity.
It kind of creates a purge. Huh?
Yeah.
Completely irrational.
Now, come on, John. I was just saying I've got plenty of time, and suddenly I don't have any time. So, this entire slide, actually, I was talking earlier, even as early as Homer, Alethes, which is the root of Aletheia, was referring to correctness and reliability, and had a different sense of meaning to what Heidegger is indicating. So, why is this, says Heidegger, and then he has a little rhetorical tirade almost. Is it because man's ecstatic sojourn in the openness of presencing is turned only toward what is present and the presentation of what is present? Answer brackets, yes it is. Yes, Martin. No, I mustn't start taking them. Is it that presence as such, and together with it, the clearing that grants it remains unheeded? Unheeded? Yes, Martin. Only what Aletheia as clearing grants is experienced and thought, not what it is as such. I'm going to stop saying the... Yes. Because he's trying to... You see what he's trying to say? He's saying that our entire attention is turned into what it is that's appearing, not the appearing as such. Is it only a consequence of the carelessness of human thinking? No. Does it happen because self-concealing, concealment, lethe, belongs to aletheia, not as a mere addition, not as shadow to light, but rather as the heart of aletheia. So he's saying something deeper here. Why is it that we don't see that this space, this unconcealment in action? And he says this several other places as well. It's almost that the unconcealing nature conceals itself. Do you see he's saying there's a dualism of that concealing and unconcealing are inextricably joined together, and the very nature of the unconcealment is itself concealed from us. And it's all poetic again, you see. He wants to indicate something about a sheltering and a preserving. That almost what remains hidden is being preserved. I mean, you might question what's going on there. What preserved from what? Because in a way, we represent a kind of a rapacious attempt to unconceal everything. Our civilization, maybe humanity as a whole. Do you know our rapacious? It was only a few hundred years ago that the Earth had a boundary beyond which there was nothing. Do you know, like you could say, the clearing for us just spread over a certain part of the Earth. And beyond that, there was the unconcealed, the hidden. And the Earth had mysteries that we couldn't imagine. Well, we did imagine. But we lived in we would have been living in a totally different world, where now every last corner, you know, the satellite has photographed your roof, your car, you in the street. Every aspect of the Earth is suddenly unconcealed, right? But only in a surface way. But even so, there's a kind of a rapaciousness in our culture's attempt to just see into everything. CCTV, you know, pouring seeing it in everybody's life, the press. I want to know everything about the royal family, anyone who's famous. Just let me read about their private life. What are they doing in bed? I just want to know everything about you on Facebook. Do you know, we're rapaciously wanting to uncover everything just for the fucking sake of it, you know. Not for any reason, apart from a kind of a consuming desire to ruin everything. So you see that I guess the indication here is that in the natural place of the unconcealing, it wants to conceal as well. It wants to hide. It wants to preserve probably from something like us, something in us. That is, it's just, we just want to, I don't know what it is we want. We're not interested in appreciating what is wild and mysterious, are we? We miss it, but if there is anything wild and mysterious, the first thing we want to do is we want to know about it. We want to send some scientists in, and we want to measure it. We want to write some books on it. We want to film it. And finally, we want to debunk it and say, well, there's no mystery there. That's it. That's what we do, isn't it, with everything. We're sort of self, and the culture itself says, yeah, we just explore the universe, and what do we discover? Just a lot of bloody rock. Just a lot of bloody rock. Rock and ice. Ice and rock. meaninglessly spinning around the sun. A few rocks, you know, asteroids, moons. Dead, just matter, just like we said. And let's send some more probes out and see if we can find some more dead matter, you know. Gosh, you know, we found, it was amazing. We expected to find some basalt, and instead we found some ice. You know, a great discovery. Oh, yeah, that's so amazing, isn't it, what we discovered. Let's spend another $1 billion on looking at some more rock. Because maybe there's some life under there. That's the great hope, isn't it? God help it if there is. All right, sorry, I'm starting to...
You're off from one.
Yes, yeah. The rational and the irrational. All right. You know Heidegger and I have a certain affinity here, don't you? It's this rationalization with its immense results justifies itself. He wants to say that... in fact, I was sort of talking about it. The frenzy of rationalization, bringing everything under the dominion or the gaze of our scientific understanding and control. We want to make everything predictable in some sense, known and predictable. And if possible, turn it to some profit. Heidegger's indicating, I think, to put it in a nutshell, given that time's moving on, that the rational and the irrational is also something that is determined within the clearing. The clearing itself is neither rational or irrational. Our being rational is a kind of a way of understanding what is in the clearing. And it's a way also of ignoring what is irrational. Casting it to one side, dismissing it. Whereas the irrational or rational, that distinction, it just doesn't... The clearing itself lies behind any distinction like that. It lies behind all distinction. Oh yeah, it's the last slide. Last. So, it was the very last slide. We all need an education in thinking, and first of all, knowledge of what being educated and educated in thinking means. This is the quotation from Aristotle. For it is uneducated not to have an eye for when it is necessary to look for a proof and when this is not necessary. I mean, Heidegger, he's fun, isn't he? Because I think to any analytic philosopher, they'd be busting a gut saying, you say that, well, what grounds have you got for all this stuff you're saying about aletheia? You're just saying nothing. You can't show me any proof. And this is his answer. He's saying, I'm not even gonna answer you. Just eat this. Eat this quote from Aristotle. Do you know, not everything can come under the dominion of this rational calculative thinking. If we want to inquire into being, we have to go via another path. And what does it mean to prove something? You see, all that he's speaking of about the clearing, in some sense or other, it's either going to be self-evident to you, immediately self-evident to you, because you grasp almost poetically what he's talking about, or it isn't. And there's no question of any proof being offered here. So he's saying this sentence demands careful reflection. In my way, I did some careful reflection, which is why I moved away from analytic philosophy, because analytic philosophy, at some level, is expecting proof. Even if it doesn't expect proof, it expects an explanation as to... Analytic philosophy generally says, okay, there are certain basic positions that you can take here that you can't prove, but you still need to justify, which is like proof. You need to say, all right, you can't prove that materialism's true, but you can provide some persuasive arguments that indicate that it's more likely to be true than idealism. And that's the business of philosophy. It's finding proofs or good reasons. Whereas this, the investigation of aletheia, of the clearing, isn't a matter of finding proof or even good reasons. It's a matter of I'd rather leave it like a silence. So the sense, for it is not yet decided in what way that which needs no proof in order to become accessible to thinking is to be experienced. I left it as a silence because in a way Heidegger's leaving it as a silence. He's saying, well, that's yet to be decided. He's almost saying, well, I'm leaving that to you. Is there anything I feel like he's saying, has anything I've said here reached you? And then he says something quite dramatic here for Heidegger scholars who spent their whole life studying being and time, of whom I know a few, who think that nothing happened after being and time. Don't ask me to pronounce that. Is well-rounded unconcealment itself, is this what is to be experienced? Is it well-rounded unconcealment itself, thought as the clearing? Does the title for the task of thinking then read, instead of being and time, clearing and presence? But where does the clearing come from, and how is it given? What speaks in the there is, it gives. Now this is another translation about what's going on in the clearing. You look, there is. He's trying to say something. Everything appears in the clearing. There is everything appearing in the clearing. But the clearing itself gives it. There's a giving in the unconcealing. There's a giving. He's trying to express again this some quality of how it stands in the clearing. And he's basically saying, so this is it. This is the task for thinking, to make the clearing explicit. Because we haven't looked at this. I mean, it's quite a simple message, isn't it? At the end of the lecture. And even if you're not a philosopher, and you don't take on the task of making it explicit by writing some kind of book, it's kind of its own reward. Becoming attuned to what Heidegger's talking about is its own reward. In the sense that it's almost a process of refinement of your own consciousness to do this. I think that's the final word.